And this is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Ken Nash, and Mimi Rosenberg is on vacation this week.
Later on, the new Jim Crow, purging the African-American vote by felon disenfranchisement, with Jazz Hayden from New York City's Riverside Church's prison ministry campaign to end the new Jim Crow. But first we hear Mimi's report.
Another aspect of the new Jim Crow, impeding the franchise. Mimi speaks with Lee Rowland, counsel with the Democracy Program's Voting Rights and Elections team at the Brennan Center for Justice, on the blockades constructed that, if allowed to stand, could preclude an estimated 5 million people from voting in the 2012 election.
Ahead of the 2012 elections, there's been a wave of legislation tightening restrictions on voting that has swept across the country. Lee, can you give us a brief account and analysis of this year's voting cutbacks?
Absolutely. And you're right to call it a wave. It's unfortunately what we at the Brennan Center have been tracking as a radical and unprecedented shift in the rules of elections. And we've seen scores of these laws proposed throughout the nation in 2011, and unfortunately, they have resulted in 21 new laws and executive actions that restrict voting in at least 14 states, and according to our calculations, could make it significantly harder for up to 5 million eligible voters to cast ballots in next year's election, which is truly tragic. And the laws that I'm talking about range from cutbacks on early voting to new and strict photo ID laws that may leave many people outside of the system. They include restrictions on student voters, and they include restrictions on voter registration and groups who try to register voters. And the really unfortunate thing about these laws is that they're not just bad for voters. They're not just kind of a sad moment in our democracy. But there is no doubt that these changes don't affect all voters equally. Minority voters, poor people, students, and people with disabilities are going to be the hardest hit by this wave of new laws.
You know, it's interesting when you said 5 million Americans. That's the number which is larger than the margin of victory in two of the last three presidential elections. So if that's what we're cutting out, good gracious, that's pretty significant.
Oh, there's no doubt that these changes will be widely felt and could sharply tilt the political terrain for the 2012 election. And unfortunately, I mean, I think the reality is that many of these laws were calculated to do precisely that, because they take aim at folks who may be perceived to vote a certain way. And, you know, the unfortunate reality is that these are likely to impact the outcome of elections in some states. We at the Brennan Center are working hard to push back against these laws and to highlight them, make sure that people are informed about them, and to reduce the impacts, the suppressive impacts of these laws in every way we can. But there's no doubt that that work is so critical precisely because they do have the possibility of making changes to the political outcomes in this country, which is unacceptable. If, you know, frankly, we don't believe, and it's an acceptable political tactic to suppress the vote and massage the electorate in a particular way. It's un-American, and it really weakens the principles of our democracy.
Now, in Florida, Governor Rick Scott signed Florida's House Bill 1355, which is a 158-page bill, which includes language that restricts the opportunity and ability of citizens and grassroots organizations to conduct voter registration drives. What are some of the burdensome and unnecessary regulations and red tape, some of the most egregious aspects of the bill that will restrict voting and are now subject to legal challenge?
Right. Well, you're right to call out the Florida law, and it's one that we have been working hard to push back against. The law, 1355, as it's so commonly known, actually includes itself includes a wave of suppressive measures within the bill. And included in that are restrictions on the way that voters can change their address at the polls. Those changes, unfortunately, will be felt hardest by those who move, which we know from census data tend to be predominantly low-income and minority voters. It also includes a dramatic cutback to the availability of early voting days. Those days in Florida have been cut down by half, from 2 weeks to one. And in particular, the law removes the final Sunday before Election Day from it no longer offers that day to the voters. We know from data, particularly in 2008, that that day was hands down proportionally the biggest day for black voters. And cutting that day out is going to have a particularly acute impact on minority voters in Florida. And then finally, as you mentioned, it's a 160-page bill, so I can't describe everything in it, but perhaps the most egregious restriction in this law, as you mentioned, is a slew of new restrictions on voter registration activity by groups like the League of Women Voters, groups like Rock the Vote, who go out and conduct voter registration drives and try and get new voters onto the rolls. Under the prior law, Florida offered a reasonable amount of time, 10 days, to collect a voter registration form from an individual voter and turn that into election officials. And that provided some limitations, of course, on that time limit, but allowed people who were nonprofit organizations, who were all volunteer-based, just like, for instance, the League of Women Voters of Florida, who is my client, it enabled them to function in some way. However, this new law reduces that time to 48 hours. And not only does it reduce it to 48 hours, it does so in a way that is unbelievably complex. It basically transforms volunteer activity that we should be encouraging. You know, it's civic participation at its core. It's American as apple pie. It transforms that behavior into an activity that is fraught with risk, with red tape, that attaches strict and high fines if you're even a minute over that deadline, that creates a bunch of tracking and reporting requirements that will do nothing to make elections more secure or help voters, but it will, and it has, put groups like the League of Women Voters of Florida out of business in terms of voter registration. They have, in reaction to this law, have passed a moratorium. And, you know, again, at the end of the day, the real loss is going to be to the voters, and in particular to minority voters who we know rely on community-based voter registration groups to vote. They are more than twice as likely, both black and Hispanic voters in Florida are more than twice as likely to register to vote with the help of one of these groups than other voters. So every single change that we've just talked about in this law is likely to directly impact minority voters most acutely, and it's truly tragic.
Now, on the heels of a speech in which Attorney General Eric Holder specifically pointed to Florida state law is an example of recent legislation that restricts Americans' ability to cast a ballot. A coalition has filed suit in federal court challenging Florida's completely onerous new restrictions on community-based voter registration. Tell us something about that. And by the way, I should say this is at least the third time that I know you have been involved in challenges to impediments imposed by Florida on voting.
That's right, and I'm happy to talk about that. It is, as you mentioned, unfortunately the third time, not the first or the second, but in the last 6 years, this is the third time that the Brennan Center has represented preeminent voter registration groups in Florida to push back against restrictions that are really an attempt to, you know, regulate this activity beyond the point at which volunteer-based groups, which community-based groups can comply with them. The really sad backdrop to all of this is that over the same period of time, over these 6 years when we've been pushing back against the state of Florida, the voter registration rate in Florida has dropped dramatically from over 70% to about 60% of eligible voters registered. So this is a time when you'd think that Florida would be doing what it could to encourage voter registration in groups that help bring people into our democracy. And instead, their top priority seems to be passing laws that we allege and our clients allege violate their constitutional rights. So just to give you a sense of what this case is about, we at the Brennan Center, along with our pro bono partners, lawyers at the ACLU of Florida, we represent three key voter registration groups that really represent the entire spectrum of the voting electorate. And we represent the League of Women Voters of Florida, Rock the Vote, and the Florida Public Interest Research Group. And we filed suit claiming that this law restricts their First Amendment rights to engage in voter registration activity. And when I say the First Amendment, that is freedom of speech, of course, but also the freedom to associate with a community of like-minded people, and that's precisely what these groups do. They go out into communities, they talk to people about their voting rights. Rock the Vote, for example, has what's called a democracy class, where they go into Florida high schools. They teach students about the history of the right to vote, the fact that 18-year-olds were granted the right to vote. They talk about the importance of exercising that right, and they get those kids registered to vote. They give them a voter registration form. They make sure they get on the rolls. Teachers, for example, are a great example of the kind of people who probably aren't going to be able to comply with that 48-hour requirement. They work full-time. Election offices will generally be closed when they're not working. And they frequently want to give their students a few days to complete those forms. And, in fact, there have been highly publicized investigations of teachers who have run afoul of this law since it was passed. And at heart, those investigations, that, you know, the fining and the attachment of civil liability to the activity of simply trying to help others register to vote, as I noted, we believe is unconstitutional. It has forced groups like Rock the Vote and the League of Women Voters of Florida to stop their voter registration activity, to stop speaking to young people, to all voters, to elderly voters about their right to vote, to organize them, make them more politically engaged, and ultimately get them out to the polls.
By the way, we should also say, correct me if I'm wrong, but the very issue of the Voting Rights Act is challenged as well in Florida.
It is, and that is in that other, you mentioned that there were lawsuits against this law, and that's indeed true. Because parts of the state of Florida are covered by the Voting Rights Act, which of course is the seminal civil rights legislation that protects minority voters in particular, it must receive federal approval to implement this law in certain of its counties. And as you indicated, Attorney General Holder specifically pointed to Florida in his speech as a troubling example of this wave of suppressive laws. And right now, the state of Florida is in court, this is a separate lawsuit in Washington, D.C., arguing that it should have the right to implement this law because it doesn't hurt minority voters. But its filings say, if we're wrong and it does hurt minority voters, then alternatively, you should hold that the Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional, which really takes some chutzpah. Because it's basically saying we're past the point where we need a Voting Rights Act, even if this law dramatically and demonstrably hurts Black and Latino voters. And if it does, well, we just ask you to strike down that seminal piece of civil rights law that protects those voters in our state. So, you know, as we talk through the law, Mimi, it's clear that not one, not two, but several of the changes to this law are going to be felt most acutely by minority voters. In the lawsuit we filed last week, we highlight how these laws as a whole violate the First Amendment, how they're vague and confusing and can't be followed. And the reality is that any way you slice it, any way you look at it, this is a bad law, it's bad policy, it's going to harm Florida voters. We at the Brennan Center and the groups we work with are doing whatever we can to push back and make sure that the impacts of these laws, particularly in the 2012 elections, are as small as they can be to the electorate.
And Mimi was talking with Lee Rolland, counsel with the Democracy Program Voting Rights and Election Team at the Brennan Center for Justice.
And now the new Jim Crow, purging the African-American vote by felon disenfranchisement. Today, nearly 5 million Americans are barred by law from voting at all because of a felony conviction. More than 1 in 50 adults can't vote. And because of the racial imbalance in the criminal justice system, 1.4 million Black men are disenfranchised. That's 13% of the African-American male population, a figure 7 times the national average. The laws vary from state to state. For example, in Maine, a convicted murderer may vote while still in prison, but in Virginia, someone arrested for selling drugs when he was 18 may never vote again. An American suffrage movement voting for felons could make a considerable difference in the upcoming elections. Now, Jazz Hayden from New York City's Riverside Church's prison ministry campaign to end the new Jim Crow.
On September 13th, 2000, I was released from prison. Now, I filed a class action lawsuit in commemoration of the brothers that died in Attica. I filed a class action lawsuit challenging the denial of the right to vote to prisoners. prisoners, parolees, and the communities they come from were class members of this class action lawsuit. And how I arrived at filing this lawsuit was the result in 1993 of some findings that were made by a think tank that I had pulled together. Robin Ganji of the Correctional Association was the inspiration for pulling together this think tank. He came into Eastern Correctional Facility. He was telling us about how the role of the Correctional Association was to oversight on the prisons. And he was told us about some reforms that he was trying to get made. Well, I wasn't interested in reforms. I wasn't interested in better environment in prisons. I was interested in getting out. And I told Robin Ganji that, and Robin Ganji told me, well, you ought to form your group to work on that. And I said, you know what? You're right. And I walked out of there, and in less than 24 hours, I put together a think tank. And we began to research the whole history of prisons in the world. And when we got back to 1993, we realized one of the findings was that prison administrators had 100% of power and prisoners had zero. So that was something I wasn't comfortable with, and the members of the think tank wasn't comfortable with either. So there were other findings as a result of our research, and one of those findings was that prisoners in four states voted from their prison cells. Can you imagine finding that out after realizing that we had 0% of power? So when we begin to look at these states, Maine, Massachusetts, Vermont, and Utah, well, they're citizens of the United States and we're citizens of the United States. How is it that they have the right to vote from their prison cells, but we don't have the right to vote? So naturally, the next step was lawsuits. There was another group in Green Haven Prison that was also doing the same research because it was the idea of time had come. And they raced ahead and they managed to hook up with a law school. They began doing research all around the country. And my group in Eastern were doing research all around the country and we'd be bumping into one another. But because they had some law professors and law school with them, they ended up filing their complaint and they filed it and they lost. I think they lost in the district court. So the next step was the Eastern group, my group, to begin to make steps towards filing this class action lawsuit. But we didn't want to jump out there pro se. So I reached out to every civil rights organization in the country. All of them. NAACP, Legal Defense Fund, NAACP, Urban League. This was in 1993. We reached out to all of them. And we still have the letters in response that said, well, we ain't got time for that right now. Or we fighting to get this flag off the state building in Okefenokee, New York, somewhere. But nobody offered to represent prisoners in this class action lawsuit. So finally, as I was beginning of reaching the point where I was getting ready to leave, on September 13th, 2000, I filed this class action lawsuit pro se. Me and some of the brothers in the law library sat down together and pulled this together. And then when I got out, they had the election in Florida, the presidential election, George Bush and Vice President Al Gore. And because of an issue that developed in Florida with them removing people from the voting eligibility list because they had the same names as people that had been disenfranchised. And the number of people that were denied the right to vote in Florida affected the outcome of that election. Suddenly now, felon disenfranchisement becomes the issue. The funders are pouring money into it. The advocacy organizations, man, are rushing to get that money in less than 2 weeks. I had three law firms. Those three law firms were the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, the Mega Evers Center for Law and Justice, and the Community Service Society of Law Firms. And we went to war, and this war went on for 6-7 years. And ultimately, we had a hearing in the Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit here, right in Manhattan. The courtroom was filled, and we had amicus briefs filed by law firms all over the country. And then the decision came back. The court split down the middle, 5-5, and therefore their ruling had no precedential value. So prisoners continue not to be able to vote. And the impact of this is what is really at issue here. Because every time they take a busload of prisoners from Harlem, they take a busload of votes. Every time they take a busload of prisoners from Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brownsville, East New York, they're taking a busload of votes. And at one time in this state here, they had over 70,000 prisoners that were denied the right to vote. And another 50, 60, 70,000 on parole that couldn't vote, right? So our community reflected this state of powerlessness that resulted as a result of having their community members locked up in these cages and stripped of the fundamental right in democracy, which is the right to vote. This is another democracy if you can't vote. That is the fundamental right. There's a guy over there in Israel killed the prime minister of Israel, Yitzhak Rabin, and they sent him to prison. And then somebody tried to take away his right to vote, and it went to the Supreme Court of Israel, and the Supreme Court of Israel said one thing ain't got nothing to do with the other. And this guy had killed their leader, and they sustained his right to vote. Well, here, we're talking about mass incarceration, we're talking about Attica, and we're talking about the prison industrial complex. This is reduced to a question of power. Because the reason that prison population expanded from 300,000 to 2.3 million, and another 5 or 6 million under the control of the criminal justice system, was a pushback against the gains of the civil rights struggle. Against the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 65, which eliminated all the barriers to the ballot box that the old Jim Crow had put in place. The grandfather clause, the literacy test, the poll tax, all these things that kept former slaves, African Americans, away from the ballot box were wiped out with the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. They left one thing in place, and that was felons disenfranchised. And all our civil rights advocates, Martin Luther King on down, when they got to their prison wall, they stopped, they celebrated their victory, and they went after the benefits of affirmative action. And meanwhile, the powers that be in this country just expanded. They expanded the prison population because there's always a pushback. One step forward, they concede something, and then they push back. Well, they push back. They passed the war on drugs, Nixon, Reagan. They expanded the prisons. And at the same time, before they did that, they pacified all of them after Attica. You know, they gave us college education, work release, TVs. they gave us all that stuff. Just be quiet a minute, man, while we fill these prisons, right? And that's what happened. So, in light of this year, all those people, that 2.3 million people behind those prison walls, and another 4 or 5 million under control of the criminal justice system, they have reversed all of the gains of the civil rights struggle. America is the biggest apartheid nation in the world. There's only two nations on this planet that have walls around their borders. That's the United States and Israel. to apartheid nation. Now you get mad at me if you want, but that's a fact. And we sit over here, the so-called left in America, we sit over here, we worried about how the Palestinians are being treated over there, we're worried about the Arab Spring, and we're worried about struggle going on all over the world. But right here in America, we have the biggest human rights travesty on this planet. We have the biggest human rights travesty on this planet. But we're so eager to run off around the world where we don't have to put our bodies on the line, and we support these movements. I'm not minimizing the importance, man, of the Palestinian struggle. I stand in complete solidarity with them. And the same with people that are legitimately struggling against oppression throughout the Arab world. I stand with them. But the way we can help them is by helping ourselves right here.
And you're listening to Jazz Haydn from Riverside Church's prison ministry campaign to end the new Jim Crow.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.